Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So there's a number of trends that are huge. Really what those trends mean is that they are, you know, each one of those will change the balance of power, and combined we don't know how they're going to change the balance of power, but they will. And you've really got to overlay, you know, over that very unpredictable geopolitical landscape, these mega trends that are creating even more unpredictability and instability in the system. So that is why I think we're probably heading for a global conflict.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Behind the Lines. I'm Arthur Snell. We live in an era of conflict, whether we're talking about the war in Ukraine, the crisis in Gaza, or numerous other conflicts around the world which sadly get very little attention. But not many people look at these conflicts at a global level, try to understand the commonalities, the factors that draw them together. One such person who is doing this is Dr. Mike Martin. Mike was in the army, he was a captain, served with some distinction in Afghanistan, and subsequently became an academic, writing well-regarded books on warfare, on Afghanistan, and on other subjects. And he's now running for Parliament in Tunbridge Wells for the Liberal Democrats. He's a really fascinating guy and worth hearing in some detail. So I spoke to Mike at some length about warfare at the global level and where we might be headed. I hope you find it interesting.
I'm Mike Martin. I'm a senior fellow at King's London, a former British Army officer, and I'm also running for Parliament for the Liberal Democrats in Tunbridge Wells.
Your history as a politician, would you say it's at all affected by your experiences in counterinsurgency in Helmand?
Great question. So let's start with an easy one, shall we, Arthur?
Yeah.
Look, so you and I were both in Afghanistan at the same time, and we were at the sharp end, really, of policy, right? Yeah. So people sit in London and they decide, or Washington or Paris or wherever, and they decide what's going to happen. And then people have to go out there and carry that out. Now, in our case, we were in a war zone, so there was particular risk attached to what we did. But you know, it's also true of policemen and firemen and, you know, during COVID, you know, nurses, doctors, all the rest of it. So lots of people have to carry out government policy. And what was really obvious to me, I think to you as well, in Afghanistan, that our policy was pretty rubbish. We didn't have a strategy. And that resulted in perverse outcomes, right? Most of the time when we poured resources into Afghanistan, we were making the conflict worse rather than better. Yeah. And had that policy strategy been set better in London, or even had there been a proper feedback loop between what was happening on the ground back to what was happening in London, perhaps we wouldn't have suffered really what was a defeat in Afghanistan. And so, yeah, it was a really important lesson in how actually this stuff's really important. Getting government right is really, really important.
Yeah.
And another aspect of that, which may be relevant, I wonder, because you're the author of a book about Helmand called An Intimate War, which really gets into the sort of the depths of that conflict and the complexities. And inevitably, like any community, you know, there is history and there's sort of backstory. And I don't want to stretch this analogy too far, but to some extent, politics is very local, isn't it? And particularly if you're running as a Liberal Democrat, where you're not going to win because of the national platform necessarily, or you know, a major kind of national policy platform. So you have to understand your locality.
Well, I actually think our national policy platform is great, and I'm really looking forward to the manifesto coming out. But you're right in the sense that, you know, in Tunbridge Wells, it's a two horse race between the Lib Dems and the Conservatives. Conservatives fight elections very differently. They do sit in London and push buttons and pour lots of money in, and then mail pops out the system in Tunbridge Wells on people's letterboxes because they've got huge amounts of money. Whereas we do have that hyper local knowledge. We've got councillors embedded across the entire constituency. We've got over 300 volunteers. We do really know it street by street and issue by issue. And I think people respond to that very well.
Yeah. This podcast isn't about local politics, but I'm sure a lot of listeners will be interested to know what you're up to. Mm. But let's move on to sort of global issues. And obviously you are a you're an author about conflict. You're an expert on war and warfare. We're in a period of clearly one extremely important war happening in Europe, the Ukraine war. There are other conflicts sort of bubbling around the world. But you have been doing a lot of thinking about this idea of a sort of global conflict and how that might escalate from the current situation. So can you sort of explain your thinking there?
Yeah, I suppose there's a few ways to look at it. And really the genesis of that, we have to go back sort of 6 or 7 years. And I was in America teaching a course to the US Marine Corps. And afterwards we went to the bar and we were just chatting. And this idea sort of came up in conversation that maybe we were in the foothills of a big global conflict. And I did a quick straw poll in the room. And bearing in mind, this room was full of officers and senior NCOs in the US Marine Corps, you know, decades of service between them. And these were people who'd fought in multiple wars and it had that intuitive sense that you can only get from being in a war zone, fighting wars. And at that time, this was 2007 and the world was much stabler then, they put the odds at 50-50 that we were going to be in a global war within the next 5 years, they said. So we're now outside of that. You know, just outside of that time frame. But I thought that was really interesting and that got me thinking. And since then, the evidence, and I know there's a risk of confirmation bias here, but the evidence seems to mount up. So I guess the first thing is that there's a decline or a perception of the decline of America's hegemonic power.
Yeah.
And we can point to stuff that, you know, makes that an objective fact. You know, America's share of the world economy is smaller, for instance, not necessarily because it has declined, but because other people, you know, China specifically, their economies have grown. But certainly that shifting balance of economic power creates a perception that the Americans are a declining, and the West more broadly, right? Because the Americans back up Europe, NATO, all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. The West more broadly is a declining power. And because of that, what you tend to get, and, you know, we saw this in the 30s, and I don't want to sort of overblow the, you know, the linkages between now and the 30s, but I think this is interesting, is that the decline or the perception of a decline of hegemonic power means that other middle ranking powers have a go. They go chancing. And we're seeing that all over the place.
Yeah.
And you know, most obviously Russia, which although it sort of technically has great power status, really it's a sort of middle ranking power. You know, Obama famously said Russia is a regional problem and not a global problem. But we're also seeing it in the Middle East. You know, the Saudi US alliance is suddenly completely different to how it's been for decades. We've obviously got the Middle Eastern war with Israel. There's sort of China and India, and Turkey is rising, and all of these, you know, people are taking risks. Leaders of middle ranking powers are taking risks where they wouldn't have taken risks previously, because they felt that actually now America's going to come in and quash anything that we do. And that's not happening anymore. So what this does is it creates a shifting tapestry of geopolitical instability. And it's very hard to point at any particular area and go, that's where the global conflict is going to start. I mean, in 1914, over the summer, nobody would have said someone's going to assassinate someone in the Balkans and that's going to trigger the alliance system that's going to lead to the First World War. But when you have multiple unpredictable geopolitical trends and movements and personalities and all the rest of it, it's hard to, it lends instability to the system. And the system, as we've had it since the Second World War in the Long Peace, and actually other periods of peace in human history, have come about because of a hegemonic power who's able to an extent, for example, police the seas, right? Which was something we're sort of starting to slowly see break down. I'm not saying in any way that the global trade is going to be, you know, cut off or anything, but we're starting to see nibblings at the edge of that maritime order.
Yeah.
And then to overlay across all of that, I mean, I've really just spoken about basic geopolitics there, but we've actually got these huge epoch-defining global challenges. So, I mean, climate change is the most obvious one.
Yeah.
AI and AI safety and automation and, you know, things related to the technology revolution. There's stuff like international taxation and the way that's done, and, you know, dark money and all that kind of stuff. Migration is obviously a key. You know, we are definitely entering an age of great migration. Demography is causing all sorts of shifts at the moment. You know, China is shrinking, India is still growing, you know, Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, or particularly the Sahel, is going to double in size, etc. So there's a number of trends that are huge. And what those trends mean is that they are, you know, each one of those will change the balance of power. And combined, we don't know how they're going to change the balance of power, but they will. And you've really got to overlay, you know, over that very unpredictable geopolitical landscape, these mega trends that are creating even more unpredictability and instability in the system. So that is why I think we're probably heading for a global conflict. So I think taken individually, what those trends mean is they mean a shift in the global balance of power. So, I don't know, let's just look at climate change. I mean, that affects crop yields. So they're going to go up in Russia. They're going to go down in other parts. Well, they're going down in the west of England because it's so wet. So, you know, 50 yields are down 15% of wheat.
Yeah.
They're also going to, you know, climate change is going to open up the Arctic sea route, which, you know, massively changes the balance of power. You know, maritime logistics are hugely important. So each of those trends on their own is going to change the balance of power. Combined, they're going to change the balance of power in hugely unpredictable ways. And that layer, we can overlay on top of that already unpredictable geopolitical layer that I spoke about at the beginning, with this perception of the decline of Western hegemony and the rise of middle-ranking powers and them chancing their luck. So that's basically why I think we're heading for a global war at some point, because the world is highly unpredictable and the world is unpredictable. People make mistakes. You know, people drift into wars by mistake without meaning to. And I think that is the world that we live in at the moment.
Yeah, fascinating. I'm very in. There's so many things I'd love to ask about it, but perhaps going back to your conversation with the Marine Corps, US Marine Corps, obviously those are some of the most kind of experienced soldiers, and it's a corps that has a very kind of battle fighting ethos. Who did they expect? That there were clearly a lot of people in that room who expected some kind of conflict to break out. Sort of who and where were they expecting that conflict?
Yeah, so this is where my thoughts break down, if you like, because I can't really point to a particular area and say, oh, it will be Turkey, Russia, or something like that. And I think in that room, the reason I tell that story is because those men, they were all men, had an emotional sense. The villi in their intestines, the little hairs in their intestines, were tingling when they thought about it. And I don't think they could have put a finger on where it was going to break out. I mean, obviously, we can point to sort of obvious flashpoints, but again, a bit like the First World War, no one would have predicted how that started. Okay, the Second World War was, you know, people were more obviously able to kind of say where the tensions would rise there. But I think it's because of the unpredictability. You know, peace is not the absence of war, right? Peace is the successful management of politics so that you don't have to use violence. And what's happening now is that we're not successfully managing the politics around all of these problems. And that is what I think gave those who and me a sense that, a feeling that we are heading for a war.
Yeah. And then another thing I'm quite interested to explore a bit is this point about the US's role. Obviously, it's easy to see the way that the US's sort of hegemonic role is to some extent under threat, partly because of the dysfunctions of its own government. You know, it can't agree to support Ukraine, although it's, you know, by a very long way the most powerful military in the world, and so on. So there are all those dysfunctions. But of course, during the long peace that post-World War II, which has continued in various ways up until this point, for a lot of that period, the US was one of two superpowers, and that was the whole dynamic of the Cold War. So what's the significance or importance of that, of the US is now a single superpower and one that is perhaps looking a bit tarnished versus this sort of idea of there being a kind of balance of power?
I think there's a couple of things there. And the reason I keep stressing the word perception is I think that there is a perception that the US is losing its luster, like you say, a bit tarnished. But actually, when the Middle East suddenly becomes unstable, it's not the Chinese that are wading in and deploying ships and all the rest of it. And I know America has a particular relationship with Israel, but who's patrolling the Red Sea, right? That's America and America's allies. And even though China benefits hugely from the passage of maritime trade, like its entire economy rests upon China being the workshop of the world. So I think that is very interesting, that actually America is still the indispensable power, even with all of these other issues. And you know, the economy is going gangbusters at the moment. The American economy is by far the most innovative and able to create wealth out of all the world's economies. And it has been for a very long time. And, you know, economics are the foundations of military power. And, you know, there's probably three ways to define a great power, aren't there? One is strong economy. The other is strong military. And the other is ideas that people aspire to. And China, America still ticks those boxes. And China doesn't tick those boxes at all to the same degree. So in terms of this single power versus the contest of the Cold War, well, because there were only two players in the Cold War, it actually meant that they were able to develop a stable system and between the two of them. And they did very, very cleverly. Like, they had clear lines for communication. So famously, they had the, you know, the red telephones on the in the White House, in the Kremlin, but they had many more layers of communication, including between the intelligence agencies. And so they had lots of points of contact so they could try and understand the other. So that was the first thing. They also broadly had defined spheres of influence. And I think they agreed that whilst they were going to fight lots of proxy wars, and they obviously did do that throughout the Cold War, there were going to be lines that weren't going to be crossed. So, like, the Americans, you know, fed the Afghan Mujahideen weapons, for instance, but there was no question that American ground troops were going to be sent to Afghanistan. For example, a bit like what we're seeing in Ukraine at the moment, actually, there's a sort of red lines put around that conflict by both sides to contain it. And I think that the Cold War system was, the other side only probably poorly at best understood what the other side was doing. But there was a sense of stability because they had these multiple points of contact and they broadly knew what the other was trying to achieve, even though there were misperceptions. Had there been three powers involved at that time, that system would have become much less stable.
Yeah.
Much, much less stable, because you're multiplying your unknowns by each other. Like, it goes up geometrically. The number of players you introduce into the system, the complexity goes up geometrically rather than arithmetically.
Yes.
Not linearly, right?
Yeah.
Exponentially. And I guess that's what we're seeing now. There are so many players in the system, and many of them are just regional, right?
Yeah.
But it means that the regional dynamics are hugely complex in, say, the Middle East or in the Maghreb or in the Sahel or in South America or wherever. That because there are so many players in them, it makes the dynamics much, much more difficult to figure out what's going to happen. It makes the system much more difficult to predict and therefore much less stable.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel that what we're looking at now, it feels like a sort of, to some extent, a rerun of parts of the 19th century, where you did have great empires. Obviously, you had the British Empire, the French Empire, but you had other middle powers that were also imperial, that also felt that they had a freedom of maneuver, that they felt that they could sort of do things without, without sort of being stopped by great powers if they could get away with it. But we haven't talked very much about China, and I suppose, obviously, that the great phenomenon that goes alongside this perception of America's power waning is the growth of China's power. Now, like all these things, there are limits, you know, that people have perhaps overconfidently predicted China will eclipse America, whereas I think more recently people are now questioning that assumption. But still, China's power is definitely growing. It's investing hugely in particularly its navy, but other military resources.
Yeah.
Its tech capabilities are definitely increasing, and perhaps, you know, some people worry that there may be way more than we perceive. So I guess there's a version of the future, you know, the sort of simplistic but not implausible idea is that China at some point challenges America directly. But of course, there could be a version of the future where, in fact, China and America then resume that kind of Cold War balance. So what's your feeling about where this is going?
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
It's interesting. Yes, I do think there were lots of overconfident predictions of China's rise. You know, only have to go back a few decades and people were talking about Japan eclipsing America. And of course that hasn't happened. Japan, the economy has sort of languished and has deflated, in fact, over the recent decades. China is still a middle-income country, effectively, if you take the whole country as a whole. Bits of it are super-duper future tech, like you say, on the seaboard, but the interior, there's still hundreds of millions of people who are living in great poverty.
Yeah.
And to coin a phrase, how to level up that country is a huge challenge.
Yeah.
There are a number of other transitions going on in the Chinese economy as well. You know, they're trying to transition from an export-led growth model, which is what really all of the Asian countries did in the post-Second World War era, to one where domestic consumption drives the economy, in the West. And, you know, South Korea and Japan have managed that. They've now got domestic markets that sustain their economies, whereas China, you know, the degree to which you'll be able to do that, you know, because there's also, you know, in the background, there's a property bubble going on that's fueled by debt. So there's a number of problems in the Chinese economy. So that's the first point. You know, come back to our three, let's use our three sort of ideas. We've got economy. So I was talking about the economy. The other is military.
Yeah.
And you rightly highlight that China has been investing huge sums of money in its military. The Navy is stark. You know, the 73 million tons of shipping have been added in recent years versus, I think 10,000, 70,000 tons of shipping have been built in America or something. I mean, extraordinary difference between the two. And again, not really spoken about, but China is trying to catch up its nuclear deterrent up to the size of America's. You know, until recently, it only had a few hundred nuclear weapons and limited number of delivery platforms. And of course, America has an arsenal of thousands. And so it would need to be have a comparable, it feels it needs to have a comparable size of nuclear deterrent in order to challenge America effectively. And but what I think is interesting about China's military growth is that really it's been trying to do the same thing as Russia, which is to go from a people heavy model of delivering military power. So a mass army, right? Mass army, you know, million man army, conscripts, you know, artillery, all the rest of it, you know, a very heavy intensive war. And it's been trying to transition from that model, which Russia had as well, to a more high tech intervention style force like Western militaries have been for a very long time. And, you know, there's reasons for that. China, because of the one-child policy, there's lots of families that only have one son in them. And if you go to war and suffer heavy population, you know, heavy casualties, then you've got population unrest because you've wiped out the only child of hundreds of thousands of families. So the problem is, though, you need to do more than spend money. And Russia found this out when they went into Ukraine. They'd spent loads of money. They had a very shiny military that looked fantastic on, you know, the May Day parades in Red Square. But when they got into Ukraine, they found that they couldn't do really simple stuff like coordinate infantry, artillery and tanks. Like, this is really basic bread and butter of ground maneuver. And I think the Chinese looked at that and thought, ah, that's interesting. If we want to take Taiwan, that's an amphibious operation across 100 miles of sea. It's an order of magnitude, several orders of magnitude, more difficult than driving across the border into Ukraine where the rail system links up. And so it's not just about spending money. It's about the doctrine, the integration, the training. You know, there's a reason why the US and the British, until recently the British, were good at fighting wars. It's because we fought lots of wars, and so we had lots of practice. And China hasn't fought a war since really the end of the 1970s when it fought Vietnam. And that's, you know, that generational memory previous generations has gone. And now there's lots of kit, but it's not necessarily integrated or is going to work well. So I think there is a slight reticence hastened by the example of the Ukraine debacle, really, for Russia. It's not necessarily achieving a military debacle. And so that's, you know, I wonder whether China feels confident in using its military. I think that's where we are with China. And then on the third one is this system of ideas. And, you know, you've rightly highlighted the tremendous problems that America has in its domestic politics. I mean, extraordinary that, you know, there's a guy who's 90, whatever it is, charges against him. And it's this extraordinary list of, and someone totally unfit for office. And, you know, and then the other party is obviously someone who's not at all that bad, but is also very old and all the rest of it. So it's not a great choice for America. Huge problems, hugely divided domestic politics. But still, the overarching concepts of what guides America and Europe, which are these ideals of, which are not necessarily being lived up to at the moment, but the ideals of democracy and free markets and all the rest of it, you know, there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people trying to get into America and into Europe at the moment as refugees. And there simply aren't the same number of people trying to get into China, quite the opposite. So I think that tells us a little bit about how attractive the ideas are that sit behind the different societies. So, I mean, that's a very long-winded answer. I'm sorry about that. But I do feel that China needs to do something pretty special to escape the you know, in economic terms, it's the middle income trap. Yeah. In military terms, it's the how do we, you know, chicken and egg, like we've got this kit, but how do we train to use it without starting a war? But if we start a war, then we might lose all of our kit. Yeah. So there's that problem. And then, you know, in ideas terms, there's not very little they can do to make their ideas, you know, more attractive to large parts of the world. So, yeah, I, and we haven't even spoken about the rise of India, right, which is right on China's doorstep, is probably going to outpace, well, population growth terms is, and probably in economic growth terms is going to outpace China as well over the coming decades. So,
yeah,
I think China needs to do something pretty spectacular to get out of the situation that it's in now.
Yeah. Well, of course, one of the things some people think it might do is try to do something about Taiwan. Now, obviously, the, as you've mentioned already, the barrier to China being able to take Taiwan in a sort of classic military invasion is huge. It's sort of D-Day landing and more. But having said all of that, the Chinese leadership, and particularly Xi Jinping, they don't hide the fact that they see what they would call a reunification and most people would call an invasion. They don't hide the fact that they see that as almost a sort of duty on them. So do you think that is a likely flashpoint, or is it actually that, as you sort of described there, that the limitations that the Chinese face, they're just not going to be able to risk that?
Yeah, I mean, you rightly identify, they've almost backed themselves into a corner, right? Mm. Because, you know, China, along with Xinjiang, Taiwan, along with Xinjiang, Tibet, Hong Kong, you know, all of these regions are meant to be kind of brought back into the fold. And if you look back over long, long, long history, Chinese leaders have always feared the domestic instability almost more than they feared external threats.
Yeah.
And so absolutely, Xi Jinping has made it a key part of his platform, if you like, is bringing all these, as he describes it, wayward bits of China back into the back into the fold. There are a number of problems. You've highlighted the military difficulty of it. There's also the thing that I hinted at earlier, which is China actually can't afford to fight a very casualty intensive war because of this situation where many families only have one child. At the other side of the ledger, again, from the one child policy, China has a number of excess males. It has about 30 million excess males. Because of the one-child policy, sons were preferred. So, and what that means is, you think, so what? But if you've got more men than women in a population, that means you're going to have a bunch of men, a whole cohort that doesn't get to get married.
Right.
And if you look back over history, when countries have ended up imbalanced with more men than women, they're more likely to go to war because you need something to do with those men. They're not married. As we all know, when we get married, we calm down a bit. We start to have children. We start to think less about adventures in foreign climes, and we sort of start to focus on more of the mundane day-to-day life. So do I think China's going to do it? I don't think an all-out invasion of Taiwan is on the cards. I think there's just too many difficulties. Do I think a blockade? Do I think everything short of total war will be tried? Yeah, I think that's definitely an option because it enables, particularly at a time of economic difficulty, right? This was one of the other deals that the Chinese leadership made with its population. You don't worry about political freedoms, but we'll make you all rich. But as soon as that deal breaks down, the population's not growing. Is the ratcheting up of tensions over Taiwan, perhaps starting a blockade, using a pretext, is that going to go on the cards to help boost their, you know, domestic stability? And again, I see almost the Taiwan thing as a way of, they want to reintegrate Taiwan or take it over, depending on your perspective. But actually, it's a very useful lever to pull if you want to generate cohesion back at home. So then it comes back to, you know, how good is America and its allies at not leaving pretexts on the table, about managing relations really well, about not leaving Xi Jinping any excuses, and working out how to, you know, if there is a blockade, how do we deal with that? How do we deal with that short of war? And that's, I think, the key question really is, how does that problem get managed? Remember, peace is the management of problems without violence, and that's very, very much how I would look at the Taiwan situation.
Let's talk a bit in the minutes we've got left about about Russia and Ukraine, because obviously that's actually a big interstate war that's happening at the moment, and we've seen a lot of limitations and flaws in Russia's approach right at the beginning, a sort of strategically inept attempted invasion, being pushed back in many places. But what Russia have also shown, which I suppose their history quite often shows, is a level of resilience and indifference to casualties and so on. And also the fact that Western incoherence, so both the American political sort of incoherence that we've talked about, but actually Europe's incoherence as well. We've got all these wealthy countries in Europe that can manufacture all kinds of high-end things, but we don't seem able to make enough, you know, artillery shells to keep the Ukrainians going. It's quite possible that in spite of being a sort of sclerotic and corrupted state, that Russia could win a war in Ukraine, and then that would force Europe into a real reckoning with its own sort of security architecture, particularly if America is, a Trump-led America is basically not very interested in NATO or even possibly departing NATO. So what do you think sort of Europe's strategic future looks like in that world?
Bleak. Europe's all talk and no trousers when it comes to security. And, you know, do I think that Russian tanks are going to get to the Atlantic coast in France? No, of course I don't. But do I think that Russia has designs on the Baltic states? Yep. Do I think Russia has designs on Moldova? Yeah, well, there's already a Russian separatist region there that obviously borders Ukraine. Do I think Russia has designs on the Balkans? Yeah, sure, by the Serbs. You know, what about the eastern border of Poland? How do we feel about that? Is that in the right place? I mean, obviously, Kaliningrad is kind of, you know, stuck on its own there, etc., right? And so that coupled with, I mean, look, if we say it's a 50-50 chance that Trump's going to get elected, which kind of, you know,
seems reasonable.
Reasonable position to take. So if Trump gets elected, I think it's a reasonable, you know, 80% chance that he will undermine the Article 5 guarantee, which is the collective defense article in the NATO treaty. And I mean, actually, in a sense, he's already said enough to, because it's not, you know, there's geopolitics relies on psychology.
Yeah.
And if you, you know, you don't have to like actually leave the NATO treaty. You can just, the American core in Europe, let's just downgrade it to a division.
Yeah.
The Article 5 guarantee, well, we don't have to leave that, but we could just say some comments, you know, quote unquote, off mic about, well, who's going to defend the Baltics?
Right.
Right.
And which he's already done, basically.
He's already done it, right? He's already done it. So Article 5, you know, is basically done. So if you've got a 50-50 chance of Article 5 not being something that we can rely on, I mean, that to me, if you're given any sort of chances in life and you're like, oh, there's a 50% chance this thing happening, then you prepare like hell, don't you, to do what you can to mitigate that threat. And I just don't see, looking around Europe, I simply don't see leaders who are acting like there's a 50% chance their security blanket's about to be taken away from them.
So, yeah, the record shows that Germany's given a lot of support to Ukraine, but yet there's still this reticence around the Taurus missiles, for example. And then on the other hand, you've got President Macron, who says all the right things. But then if you look on paper, what support have France actually given? I know there's a debate about some of it being classified. There may be more than, but it clearly isn't at the level that it would need to be to really make the difference. So it does feel as if, as you say, that Europe should know that it's facing a potentially catastrophic situation, and yet it's sort of, it's busy making coffee and having chats rather than actually, you know, putting its shoulder to the wheel.
I don't see any leaders around Europe really who are, and they should obviously all be working together on this, but I don't see anyone individually or collectively who is acting in a way like there's a 50% chance their security blanket is about to be withdrawn. And that includes the UK government, who in the budget a couple of weeks ago, whenever it was, actually cut capital expenditure on defence in over the next couple of years. I mean, extraordinary. There is a land war in Europe about the eastern border of Europe and the government. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And I think partly that's because, you know, never underestimate the power of denial in human beings. So they're looking at it going, nah, it won't happen. Either Trump won't get elected, or if he does, it'll be fine. We've got NATO. You know, they've had this blanket for 80 years or whatever it is, and they just can't imagine it being pulled away. So I think that's definitely happening. I think the other thing that is happening is after the end of the Cold War, politics in Europe particularly became very technocratic for quite a long time, certainly until the ructions of, you know, the mid-2010s with Brexit and all the rest of it. Politics in Europe almost became apolitical. It's famous Francis Fukuyama, the end of history, right? We solved all the big political questions, and therefore everything's technocratic now. Everything's a spreadsheet. And there was a whole generation of leaders who stopped thinking geopolitically and just viewed the world as a spreadsheet. So Merkel, you know, famously, well, let's turn off, I'm not making any comments about the individual positives or negatives of these things, but taken together, this is what Merkel did. She switched off Germany's nuclear power capability, or said we're not going to build anymore, right? So we're not going to grow it after the Fukushima problem in Japan.
Yes.
And she also at the same time allowed Germany to become incredibly dependent on Russian gas. Effectively, she felt that the way to deal with Russia was to build economic links with them. And at the same time, of course, the German military is, you know, although growing now, for a long time was kind of not really a serious military. You know, they went to Afghanistan, they wouldn't do missions at night, for instance, and stuff like that. Like, this is not a serious war-fighting military. And you take all those things together and you think, how could you be so naive? Like, we've had a long line of signals from Russia, from Chechnya in the 90s, Georgia in 2008, so on and so forth. Long series of signals from Russia that they view the world in a very geopolitical way. And there's a bunch of scores that they feel, particularly Putin feels, need to be settled after the end of the Cold War. Famously, he said the Berlin Wall falling was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. And, you know, there is this whole generation of leaders, you know, including in the UK, you know, our Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, came from finance. You know, he worked in banks. Nothing wrong with that. Very useful. We need bankers. We need people who work in finance. But does that, and then he went into the Treasury, and then he went straight to being Prime Minister. So he's never really had any experience outside of viewing the world through spreadsheets. But of course, that's not what war geopolitics is like. War is not a spreadsheet. It's a conversation. And it rests very heavily on human psychology. And if you've never had that experience of having to think in a strategic, psychological way, you're just not equipped to be a leader of a country in the current age. And, you know, I cite Sunak, but I could cite, you know, many other leaders around Europe. And I think that's the situation that we're in now. And I do wonder, a bit like in 1940, when Chamberlain, you know, in the UK was ill-equipped to deal with the situation, and Churchill rose to power and then was obviously famously a brilliant war leader. I wonder whether we're at a stage now where the current crop of politicians across Europe, when it comes to the crunch, will just get swept aside, and other people who are thinking in a strategic, psychological sense get brought to power democratically through the systems, as we saw in 1940. But my fear is that, you know, cometh the hour, cometh the person, fine, but will it actually be too late? Because when Churchill swept to power in 1940, the UK had been rearming for years. We'd been thinking about our defence. We'd been rearming for years. And Churchill came in and was able to take over a vast apparatus that had been built up underneath his predecessors. Yet we're not doing that now. We are not rearming. And so even if we do change our leaders at the last moment to get some in that know what they're doing, I fear that we won't have done the years of prep work that you need to. And you can't just turn on the tap with military resources. It takes years and years and years to build them up. And that is my fear at the moment.
Well, we're going to leave it at that sort of thought-provoking point. Of course, it wouldn't be bad if men with military experience and geopolitical sort of mindset were in Parliament. So I'm going to finish by wishing you best of luck with your ongoing campaign. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Arthur.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Behind the Lines. It was presented by me, Arthur Snell, and I also produced it. The theme music is by Matty Benbrook. Don't forget to subscribe if you enjoyed this episode, you want to hear other ones. And also, give us a good review. Makes a big difference. Thanks. See you next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.